I join in this national all-party appeal because I am convinced that our people desire to progress in political freedom and economic well-being by evolution and not by catastrophe. This cannot be done if the foundations are laid on the earthquake ground of opposition threats to social stability. This is a time of great opportunity for men of good will and vision. Masses of the best of our citizens resent party fighting at present and wish us to pursue commonwealth ends in cooperation so as to produce the maximum of good. Moreover, men's outlook and moral values are changing a great deal, and the creative influences which want expression in national life are hampered under any one party label. We were brought together to save the state. We remain together to launch it in a wide and beneficent policy of expansion. And then consider the international situation. I need not eulogize the virtues of peace, nor enforce its need. I have spent too much of my life in pursuit of peace, and led in too many assaults against war in Geneva, in Washington, and elsewhere, to make it necessary for me to recite to you my creed. I care no less for peace today than I have ever done, and I should have neither art nor part in a government which I could not trust in its pursuit of peace. The record of the national government of Geneva has been one of the peacemakers. After the events, certain critics have been saying that if they had been in charge, they would have shown more prevision. But unfortunately, for the least modest and most self-assured of them, they have been tested already and will undoubtedly be found by history to be responsible for the most serious blunders which are still amongst the formidable obstacles to world tranquility. Our strenuous work at Geneva to remove the difficulties in the way of the recognition of the German claim to equality, our successful labors to get Germany to return to the League after its first severance from that body, our plan of disarmament, which I produced, acting for the government, will stand out conspicuously as special services rendered by this government to peace and disarmament. Sir Samuel Hoare and Mr. Eden have explained the policy they have pursued since they became responsible for Geneva, and I can add nothing to their plain and definite statements. During recent months, the peacemaker has had a hard task, beset first of all by resignations from the League, by great schemes of rearmament, by the tearing up of pledges attached to the Covenant and signatures affixed to the Kellogg Pact. We have had to walk warily. We have had to face the fact that the arms necessary for our defense have been found under the new conditions to be inadequate, and we propose to make them good. In these times, when aggressors kill before they declare war, the government which leaves women and children and old people without defense would be justly judged to be criminal. We have also accepted as loyal members of the League our share in mutual responsibility to act together to maintain peace and security. But only together, not separately and alone.
I am speaking to you from the Cabinet Room at 10 Downing Street. This morning, the British ambassador in Berlin handed the German government a final note stating that unless we heard from them by 11 o'clock, that they were prepared at once to withdraw their troops from Poland, a state of war would exist between us. I have to tell you now that no such undertaking has been received, and that consequently this country is at war with Germany. You can imagine what a bitter blow it is to me that all my long struggle to win peace has failed. Yet I cannot believe that there is anything more or anything different that I could have done and that would have been more successful. Up to the very last, it would have been quite possible to have arranged a peaceful and honorable settlement between Germany and Poland. But Hitler would not have it. He had evidently made up his mind to attack Poland, whatever happened. And although he now says he put forward reasonable proposals which were rejected by the Poles, that is not a true statement. The proposals were never shown to the Poles, nor to us. And though they were announced in the German broadcast on Thursday night, Hitler did not wait to hear comments on them, but ordered his troops to cross the Polish frontier the next morning. His action shows convincingly that there is no chance of expecting that this man will ever give up his practice of using force to gain his will. He can only be stopped by force. And we and France are today, in fulfillment of our obligations, going to the aid of Poland, who is so bravely resisting this wicked and unprovoked attack upon her people. We have a clear conscience. We have done all that any country could do to establish peace. But a situation in which no word given by Germany's ruler could be trusted, and no people or country could feel itself safe, had become intolerable. And now that we have resolved to finish it, I know that you will all play your part with calmness and courage. At such a moment as this, the assurances of support which we have received from the Empire are a source of profound encouragement to us. When I have finished speaking, certain detailed announcements will be made on behalf of the government. Give these your close attention. The government have made plans under which it will be possible to carry on the work of the nation in the days of stress and strain that may be ahead. But these plans need your help. You may be taking your part in the fighting services or as a volunteer in one of the branches of civil defense. If so, you will report for duty in accordance with the instructions you receive. You may be engaged in work essential to the prosecution of war or the maintenance of the life of the people, in factories, in transport, in public utility concerns, or in the supply of other necessaries of life. If so, it is of vital importance that you should carry on with your jobs. Now, may God bless you all, and may he defend the right. For it is evil things that we shall be fighting against. Brute force, bad faith, injustice, oppression, and persecution. And against them, I am certain that the right will prevail. Early this morning, without warning or excuse, Hitler added another to the horrible crimes which already disgrace his name by a sudden attack on Holland, Belgium, and Luxembourg. In all history, no other man has been responsible for such a hideous total of human suffering and misery as he. He has chosen a moment when perhaps it seemed to him that this country was entangled in the throes of a political crisis, and when he might find it divided against itself. If he has counted on our internal divisions to help him, he has miscalculated the mind of this people. I am not now going to make any comment upon the debate in the House of Commons, which took place on Tuesday and Wednesday last. But when it was over, I had no doubt in my mind that some new and drastic action must be taken if confidence was to be restored to the House of Commons and the war carried on with the vigour and energy which are essential to victory. What was that action to be? It was clear that at this critical moment in the war, what was needed was the formation of a government which would include members of the Labour and Liberal oppositions, and thus present a united front to the enemy. What had to be ascertained was the conditions which would be necessary to enable such a united government to be formed. And to this question, I devoted myself with the assistance of some of my colleagues yesterday afternoon. By the afternoon of today, it was apparent that the essential unity could be secured under another Prime Minister, though not under myself. In those circumstances, my duty was plain. I sought an audience of the King this evening and tendered to him my resignation, which His Majesty has been pleased to accept. His Majesty has now entrusted to my friend and colleague, Mr. Winston Churchill, the task of forming a new administration on a national basis. And in this task, I have no doubt he will be successful. For that purpose, my other colleagues in the government have intimated to me that they will place their resignations in Mr. Churchill's hands, but they will, of course, retain their present offices pending the appointment of the new government. I should perhaps say to you that Mr. Churchill has expressed to me his strong desire that I should be a member of the War Cabinet. And I have told him that I will gladly give him any assistance that I can in that capacity.
During the period, it's almost exactly 3 years, that I have been Prime Minister, I've borne a heavy load of anxiety and responsibility. As long as I believed there was any chance of preserving peace honorably, I strove to take it. When the last hope vanished and war could no longer be avoided, I strove equally hard to wage it with all my might. Perhaps you remember that in my broadcast of September the 3rd last year, I told you that we should be fighting against evil things. My words have proved to be insufficient to describe the vileness of those who have now staked everything on the great battle just beginning. Perhaps it may at least be some relief to know that this battle, though it may last for days or even weeks, has ended the period of waiting and uncertainty. For the hour has come when we are to be put to the test, as the innocent people of Holland and Belgium and France are being tested already. And you and I must rally behind our new leader, and with our united strength and with unshakable courage, fight and work until this wild beast that has sprung out of his lair upon us be finally disarmed and overthrown.
People say, many people, we ought not to allow ourselves to be drawn into a theoretical antagonism between Nazism and democracy. But the antagonism is here, now. It fills our lives. It is this very conflict of spiritual and moral ideas which gives free countries a great part of their strength. You see these dictators on their pedestal, surrounded by the bayonets of their soldiers and the truncheons of their police. On all sides they are guarded by masses of armed men, cannons, airplanes, fortifications, and the like. They boast and vaunt themselves before the world. yet in their hearts there is unspoken, unspeakable fear. They are afraid of words and thoughts. Words spoken abroad, thoughts stirring at home, all the more powerful because forbidden. These terrify them. A little mouse, a little tiny mouse of thought appears in the room, and even the mightiest potentates are thrown into panic. They make frantic efforts to bar out thoughts and words. They're afraid of the workings of the human mind. Cannons, airplanes, they can manufacture these in large quantities. But how are they to quell the natural promptings of human nature, which after all these centuries of trial and progress has inherited a whole armory of potent and indestructible knowledge? Dictatorship, the fetish worship of one man, against which the British and American constitutions have elaborated their provisions. Dictatorship can but be a passing phase, a state of society where men may not speak their minds, where children denounce their parents to the police, where a businessman or small shopkeeper ruins his competitor by telling tales about his private opinion. Such a state of society cannot long endure if it is brought continually in contact with the healthy outside world. The light of civilized progress, with its tolerances and cooperation, with its dignities and joys, has often, as history shows, been blotted out. But I hold the belief that we have now at last got far enough ahead of barbarism to control it and to avert it, if only we realize what is afoot and make up our minds in good time. Of course we shall do it in the end. We shall sure do it. But how much harder our toil for every day's delay. That is what I have to say to you on this occasion. And let me say, is this a call to war? Does anyone pretend that preparations for resistance against aggression amounts to the unleashing of war? There indeed is a sorry tale. I declare it to be the sole guarantee of peace, the finest and the surest prospect of peace, the swift, organized gathering of forces to confront not only military but moral aggression, the resolute and sober acceptance of their duty by the English-speaking peoples and by all the nations, great and small, and they are many, who wish to walk with them. They are faithful and zealous comradeship, armed, effectual. This would almost between night and morning clear the path of progress and banish from all our lives the fear which already darkens God's sunlight to hundreds of millions of men. Français, c'est moi, Churchill, qui vous parle. Pendant plus de 30 ans, dans la paix comme dans la guerre, j'ai marché avec vous et je marche encore avec vous aujourd'hui sur la vieille route. Cette nuit, je m'adresse à vous dans tous vos foyers, partout où le sort vous a conduit.
Et je répète, la prière qui entoure vos louis d'or. Dieu protège la France.
Assemblez vos forces pour l'aube, car l'aube viendra. Elle se lèvera brillante pour les braves, douce pour les fidèles qui auront souffert, glorieuse sur les tombeaux des héros. Vive la France! Et vive aussi le soulèvement des braves gens de tous les pays qui cherchent leur patrimoine perdu et marchent vers les temps meilleurs.